Hello everyone and welcome to this week's episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with myself, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined as ever by Phil Brynan and Joe Kirk. Hello.
Hello.
So this week's session was not very prepared, but I think sometimes that works in our favour because the conversation just spirals in all sorts of directions. But as you know, because you're listening to it was exploring individual rights, which we did. How'd you find it?
We did. Well, I thought it was good. And what was kind of nice and refreshing is we hardly talked about subject access requests.
Yeah. You know, yeah.
Which was good. And we had some really good interaction on legitimate interest assessments and minimization. And yeah, some good discussion, some great ideas, and some differences of opinion as well, which is what we were, I think one of the things you wanted to try and highlight, Joe, was, you know, how well positioned are we as data protection practitioners to represent the interests of data subjects when we're doing trying to balance, commerciality or service delivery against privacy and rights?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I actually thoroughly enjoyed that session. I kind of like it when it's a little bit less prepared because it always feels like a little bit more organic sort of thing. And you're quite right. Yeah, it was nice to kind of, weigh up, where does a DPO kind of sit? Because obviously they are employed by an organisation, aren't they? But, they also have a duty to protect individuals' rights and freedoms. So we did explore that a little bit. And David unmuted, didn't he? And gave us an insight. We should probably get him on as a guest speaker, really.
Cause he's definitely very good, isn't he?
He's very good and he always unmutes. Yeah. So we should probably reach out to him and see if he wants to do that. If you're listening, David, please feel free to reach out. But yeah, I did. I thought it was a great session.
Spent the first 20 minutes. Sorry, Joe. First 20 minutes talking about cookies, didn't we? Which was
we did.
Again, that was good. It should have been a natural lead in because cookies and rights, but it wasn't quite so coordinated. But yeah, it was good.
When are they ever coordinated, Phil? We always go off on a tangent.
Yeah.
So what bits did you think were the most useful, Jazz? What was the most enjoyable bits or most useful bits?
I like discussing the DPDI bill and how that might affect people's rights, especially around, the change to the role of the DPO and the ICO's role as well. And then as well, that point that I touched on towards the end of the session around exemptions that aren't often thought about or known, to be honest, in general. I think a lot of people aren't aware that they actually exist, so they're probably not implemented appropriately. But yeah, I think that was my highlights. What about yours, Joe and Phil? Go on, Joe.
We've already told them.
Oh. All right. Well, I quite liked the discussion, thinking about objections to processing and restrictions to processing, that kind of rights relating to the processing activities, and kind of this other abstract one about, the ICO has made a ruling against Serco on facial recognition, and is that a new right that we've got? The right to not have your biometric information used for what I characterise as frivolous purposes. That whole kind of discussion around that for me was quite thought-provoking.
It was a really good session. I think it's one that we can talk about for hours on end, really, so it probably will be creeping up probably quite soon, especially while we've got a calendar to fill. But yeah, we hope you enjoy this one in the meantime, and stay around for a part two.
Busy. I've got some projects I'm working on, trying to get finished by the end of the month, which is proving challenging. So I'll probably get them done by the beginning of next week. But how about you?
I've had a really good week, actually. So it's quite on topic. So we've bought, some of my customers that are listening will know, some won't. So it's a little announcement for you as well. We'll be sending an email out. But we bought a SAR platform. And, it's now in-house and we've been working all SARs through that. And we've seen really good responses to it already. So it's just made the process so much easier. You know how complicated it was before with sending over in PDF format and this and that. But now we've got this platform that duplicates information.
And is it right you've managed to reduce the price as well, because we've got the platform in house rather than having to use it out. Well, win-win.
So for some that weren't using it beforehand, it's, I mean, even they're seeing the benefits of it, to be fair, in because it reduces the redaction time that we spend on it as well, because it's like it's got in it. I don't know if you've, I'm assuming you've had a deep look into it, Joe. I don't think you will have, but you know, like similarity reports in school that you'd have like on assignments and stuff, or university, it's got that. So you can find email chains that are similar, you know, that go off just a slight different way, and but it's got most of the same information. You can just remove them in bulk. You can just navigate your way through it. It's got a log with it that documents the reasons for redactions for each page. Like, it's really exciting. So yeah, been
very
a good,
good
week. Yeah,
right, very good. Have you had your hands on it as well, or have you been under the hood seeing how it works? And
so not since
not
we
for a while
it in-house. Yeah. No, but I used to work, I used to help out with SARS, and it was a painful time of my life.
Not because of the SARS, presumably.
No, no, of course not. It was, yeah, but it was, yeah, it's got great features with it, and I think now that we've got it ourselves, it's I don't know, I think what we can do with it will be quite exciting.
Yeah, it's
quite
a lot
broad
better, isn't it?
Yeah,
yeah, very good, very good. Well, the stuff I've been working on has been mostly, I have to say, Jamaica. So I've been doing Jamaican Data Protection Act readiness assessments.
Oh, yeah.
I've been project managing a massive seafood manufacturing business's compliance project, all remotely. Sadly, I'm still statting Great Ayton in North Yorkshire rather than Montego Bay. But, you know, I'm working on it. And then I've got another
in progress.
One. Yeah, another client I've been writing privacy information. So we finished doing their kind of data mapping audit, and now we're using that data to do the registration particulars, which you have to do over there, and drafted all the policy framework up. And I've been writing privacy notices this week for them, which has been quite interesting. And then Ross has done a really good job on building a Jamaican Data Protection Act training video. So that is going to get finished off next week with, you know, making sure that it all works, you know, how we want it to work on the screen, and then convert it to a video format. And then I'm going to use that out there as well. So it's been really, really busy. I'm just trying to get things finished off, though, so I can get back to some of the other stuff that I want to work on.
Mm. It sounds exciting, though.
Yeah, it's been good actually. I could quite enjoy it, 'cause it's quite challenging, you know, to pick up this new legislation and, you know, tailor everything, you know, our approaches and everything to that, you know, and just terminology is different, you know, not principles but standards, not seven of them but eight of them. But I said before on here that, you know, it's much more stringent than the GDPR. I mean, there's some features of it which I really like, but I think they're very hard. Operation. For instance, you got to submit an annual return. They call it a data protection impact assessment. You've got to basically submit by the 31st of March every year. You've got to submit this document to the ICO equivalent over there. You know, and you've got custodial sentences up to 10 years for breaches. You've got a report. Data protection officers are legally obliged to report non-compliances as well as data breaches. So there's some real, you know, tough, I think, things in there that see how it goes. It's been quite fun.
Yeah, and you've been helping me this week, Phil, a little bit.
Yes, I did your shopping for you, which is very nice. Got you some soup and bread and milk. And
no, I wish.
Smith apples.
If we've got time, my week's kind of been thrown upside down, really, because it's been quite hectic. I've kind of been in the middle of finishing off a new piece of work that we've actually not delivered before. And it was, it's been a cookie audit.
There's more of that. Yeah, I think we need to do more of that as well.
I agree. Yeah, there's defo scope to do that moving forward. And it's been a learning experience, to say the least, but something that I think, you know, organizations that are going to have to probably start doing moving forward, you know, off the back of their joint paper that they brought out last year with the CMA, I believe it was, on cookies, you know, because the ICO are clamping down, aren't they, now, with non-compliances around cookie banners and you know, cookies that are placed on people's websites. So yeah,
it's quite interesting. I mean, I've really enjoyed doing it. It's been quite stop start, hasn't it? Because the tricky bit, which I think everyone is going to face, is trying to find out what actually is going on and who've authorized it on these websites. It's not easy, is it? So a client did a scan of their top 200 page on the website, and it threw up 7,300 and something cookies, 68 distinct different cookies. But they occurred over just under 7,500 times on the 200 pages that are viewed. But nearly 4,000 you know, web beacons, pixels and tags. Again, we've
looked
at those and found that a lot of them are just images that are presumably stored online and called into the page. But there's 89 tracking scripts on those pages and some web beacons. I'm not sure web beacons, again, people on here will know more about it than we do probably, but the web beacons technically I don't think a major problem, but I think the pixels are, because they're reading information from devices, therefore caught by regulation 6 of the PECA. I think the web beacons work on the web and don't actually write or read to the device. I think maybe that depends on how they're put together, but that's been quite interesting, hasn't it, Joe, getting under the skin of that and trying to tease out. And you know, we've got this tool the client's using to do the cookie audit, and we're just interpreting the results, and you know, there's a large proportion of the cookies that it hasn't categorized, and I think there's something it hasn't categorized correctly. So if you look at the functional cookies, it's saying, oh, this cookie is used for tracking. Why is it not in the tracking cookies section?
Yeah.
So got grave doubts about the capability of this cookie tool.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't know if anyone listening has done such a scan before and has a reliable you know, tool to use to scan cookies on your website. And if you do, would you be able to just drop it, either drop it in the chat or reach out to me? And I think we'd be quite interested when we fill in kind of, you know, maybe looking at that as a tool moving forward.
Yeah, Peter's put up the European Data Protection Board's website auditing tool. We'll have to have a look at that. The OneTrust cookie module is what we've been using, and it's been quite dubious, I think, you know.
Agreed.
Just even they ran 5 different scans, and it came back with 5 different sets of results, which was worrying in the first place.
Yeah.
They told us they had 30 million cookies registered, but there's some really obvious ones like Microsoft cookies that we can Google and find out what they are, and the tool isn't capable of classifying them. And I think some of the classifications are wrong. So I've got very little confidence in that tool, unless it's been badly configured.
Yeah, potentially. You know, we've not really had our hands on it, have we? We've not been the ones that have kind of, you know, set the parameters, but they conducted a scan, didn't they, on, you know, a set amount of pages within the span of a couple of months. And it, although some of the cookies, you know, remain the same, there was some inconsistencies. And I know, of course, you know, you can introduce new cookies, can't you? And you can reduce them. But we felt that it was a little bit kind of, I don't know, it just didn't quite feel right, did it? And
Well, there were sufficient inconsistencies to be able to pick holes in it. And you don't want a tool you can pick holes in. It's got to be bulletproof, really, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So we decided to take a risk-based approach, didn't we? We felt that was probably the more appropriate method.
Yeah. So, the learning is, you know, from... Sorry, Jazz, we're going off on a tangent here. But the learning is, kind of a governance point of view, nobody's in control of what cookies are placed, you know, on the website, what tags and pixels and cookies are actually adopted by the business. You know, and then, you know, they've got this tool, which we're not convinced is... accurate. And then you've done work on the cookie banner and the consent mechanism, haven't you, Joe? And again, there is just room for improvement. But I mean, this is something, because the ICO has got the knives out for cookies, you know, I think there's going to have to be more consideration of how to approach it. Again, I'm not sure what their regulatory approach would be. They write to somebody, you know, because they've got this AI tool they're developing to scan every website, you know, very rapidly. So they're going to catch up with everybody.
But how accurate is that going to be? You know, if they're using AI to kind of scan, you know, we know how inconsistent AI can be, you know, as you use it in your day-to-day practices. So,
but if you were designing a tool, all you need to show is that something's not compliant. So I think you could, so if I was designing an AI tool to scan cookies, I'd be saying, right, let's have a count of all the cookies, tags, pixels, etc., and how many is in the cookie policy. And if there's any discrepancy, you're not compliant, you know, it's as simple as that. And the opt-out mechanism, you know, what the consent mechanism, and look for the word legitimate interest. So you could probably write an AI tool that'll do a good job of showing that it's non-compliant, rather than a tool that could show you are compliant. I think it's a lot easier to show a negative than a positive.
Yeah, I agree.
So
anyway, so that's what we've been busy this week.
that was a rounded answer, to be fair, but those of you who are new to the session, we normally spend the first 15 minutes talking about this and what's been on in the news and so on. There hasn't been much in the news. We will get to, you know, the main topic of rights. There's been elements of that already, obviously, but have you seen anything in the news before we go on to the main part of the session?
The only really main story I've seen is around the lawsuit that Grindr faced and is facing off the back of them sharing HIV status and test results to third parties for what they said was commercial purposes. I'm not really sure why they felt that was appropriate. And I guess I don't think it's fully understood the facts and figures of why they felt they could share that information, but I don't think it's unreasonable to assume that if they were relying, you know, if the purpose was for commercial purposes, then the lawful basis would probably be explicit consent, I'd have thought. So I guess that's where it's kind of come from, that I don't think anyone would agree to a dating app sharing your HIV status to third parties for commercial purposes.
It's going back a few years, isn't it? This is like between 2018 and 2020, so it seems to have taken 4 years to rumble through.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know where it kind of came from. I think it kind of stemmed from someone kind of
Norwegian,
put it out.
Wasn't it?
Is that what it is? Yeah,
I think so.
Someone
yeah.
put it out there, and then kind of everyone's powered in, going, "Oh yeah, actually, I think I've noticed that." Or you know,
I think the Norwegian Data Protection Authority fined Grindr maybe last year. Maybe last year, and I can't remember what the violations were, but I think maybe that's where it's all come from after that investigation. But yeah, go on, Jasmine.
No, I was just going to say about another news piece around TikTok. So it's potentially facing bans on throughout Europe and America. So in terms of the US, they've been given, I think it's 9 months, or I don't know if that's just the length of the procedure, to sell ByteDance, you know, TikTok's owner, to sell the company, or they're going to ban it within the US. And the European Union has kind of not backed onto that, because that's US legislation that's brought that in, but they're looking at a ban, saying that its addictive tendencies are just of concern, and I think especially around processing children's data. So we'll see how that one unveils as well.
Well, what will selling it achieve though? I don't really understand, like.
So there's two different reasons. So the EU is coming from data protection, privacy standpoint and concern, whereas the US is coming from a political standpoint. So I think the US doesn't like the fact that a Chinese owned company is potentially selling this data to their, you know, law enforcement or whatever. Whereas with the EU, obviously, it's around protecting children's data and just protecting children in general, to be honest, because it is very addictive.
It is, yeah. I agree.
What were you going to say, Phil?
The two things I saw in the news, one I thought was maybe old news, but it's just confirming that the ICO, the Experian went to the upper tier tribunal, didn't they, and about the ICO's enforcement action, and it appears they've lost that, which is interesting.
Yeah.
So I saw that, and then hot off the press is I've posted a new story that a Newcastle United fan, that's a football team for those who don't follow football, Jasmine, Newcastle United fan has been banned after she posted some comments on Twitter or X, whatever it's called these days, expressing critical opinions about transgender people. And someone complained to the club, and they referred it to the Premier League, and they seem to have done lots of reviewing of her social media. They've even got in this dossier of information about her, apparently, photographs of her walking at a dog around a park in wherever she lives. And it just seems, you know, quite invasive. You know, what kind of gives the club the right to have a look in all their social media posts? Now, some people might say, well, it's all in the public domain, isn't it? You know, but you know, is it right that they'll be using that information for that purpose, for introducing a 3-year banning order? Just seemed really odd to me.
Joe? Sorry, I was reading chat.
Yeah, so was I. Sorry, Phil. I agree, Phil. No. Well, we're 20 minutes in and we've not even touched the topic, so we probably should move on, because there's 100 people sat in here thinking, when are they going to start talking about information rights?
Yeah. Yeah, the police were involved, but she went off to be a voluntary interviewee with the police, but they took no action against her. You know, interesting. Anyway, yes, rights.
So, Phil, you wanted to break down, you know, the different types of rights available under the GDPR, because I think generally, you know, it's those within. Oh, you're testing me on what chapter it is, but from, let's say, articles 15 to about 21 is what's normally thought of, but then, you know, in terms of access and so on.
I think that's right, isn't it? But I like to think of the rights in four kind of types of rights. So there's rights to information about their protest activities, like, you know, the article 13, 14, and the requirement to provide details of safeguards for international transfers. So kind of rights to information is one type of right. Then rights relating to personal data itself, I think, is another type of right. So erasure, correction, access, portability, that's actually affecting the data. And then there's rights relating to data processing activities. So objections to processing, the cessation of direct marketing, withdrawal of consent, restriction of processing, human involvement in automated decision making, and potentially now, following Serco, you know, the use of biometric information for, let's say, frivolous purposes, maybe. I don't know how to describe them. So, you know, they are rights that would affect your processing activities as opposed to the data. And then there's rights to remedies, like to complain to the ICO, compensation and intervention through the courts. And I think, because I mean, I think of them that way, you know, each of those different types of rights requires a different response, you know. So the right to information is obvious, you know, provide it and update it if you change anything significant. But most people, I find, you know, certainly lay people, they focus in on SARs, and they're focusing on the rights that have, you know, affect data, subject to access request, the right of access to information, and they don't really have any notion in many cases of these other rights. But dealing with the right to you know, object to some processing, I think, can be really quite tricky. So if you've got an overnight process, lifting data, transferring it to another system, overnight process, and somebody can legitimately object to that, let's think rent sense in the social media, social housing world. You know, I object to my data being picked up by this third-party application and pushed over to Experian or Mobisoft, whatever. Well, how do you stop that? You know, you've got to be able to intervene in that specific process and write exceptions into the business rules and the business logic. So, and some tools that might be really easy, and other processing activities might be really quite hard.
Yeah.
So that's why I like to think of it in four types. Because I think you have to, I think you start thinking about them in different ways. Well, I do anyway, when I break them down like that.
That you've just touched on RentSense there, and I think that, you know, that consideration just amplifies the importance of thinking about this, you know, in the first instance, especially if you've got like a portal you're developing or new software or whatever it is. It's so crucial to think of rights straight away, because if, you know, if you implement, I mean, we talk about that example all the time of somebody wanting their employee start date on a HR system to be erased, you know, that they didn't consent to it or whatever, and this organization couldn't remove that start date off the employee profile on the HR system, because that's how the HR system came, and it ended up going to the ICO. I mean, it sounds like a small issue to some. Obviously there's reasons why this individual's unhappy with it, but it causes a massive problem in that sense. They had to consider whether they could remove that through the third party, whether the third party could remove that from the platform, or if they had to look to an alternative. And in this instance, I think the third party said, look, that if you want us to take that out, it will be $30,000, because, you know, it's a bespoke platform.
It seems strange. One would have thought that start date was a critical piece of information that you need.
It is to, you know, the HR team or whoever, but this was I'd say public profile, public to all employees within the organization. So their justification was, look, it's useful to know when X employee started because of their level of experience. New starters can go to them with questions, which is a bit of a loose, you know, justification. But there could be some benefit in it, but this person obviously didn't see that. So it just carried on and took a lot of time to, you know, to get out the other end, really.
Yeah, I would have thought that, you know, you need to retain that as well going forward, because if you're wanting to verify references and that type of thing, it's a key piece of information.
It was more the publicizing it for the whole organization to see rather than those that needed to know. It's not deleting it outright, just removing it.
Restricting access to it. You make a great point, which is the restriction of processing, which arguably access to data. Well, how are we going to actually implement that if we have a tricky case like that where our systems don't actually allow us kind of the field level security in a role-based access control environment? It can be very hard to do. But I mean, what's the obligation there to say, well, we can't do it, therefore we can't do it? Or how far do you have to go?
Yeah, I mean, they were relying on legitimate interests in that instance. So I think they tried to justify like an overriding legitimate interest because of the financial reasons behind it and the fact that they needed, they saw the benefit in it in terms of sharing that with other employees. It was,
interesting. I think the point that I'm taking from this is how well equipped are we to put ourselves in the shoes of data subjects when we're doing a balancing of rights, and determining whether something is necessary and whether it is overriding a right to not have something done. And I think that's quite a tricky place for DPO to be.
Definitely. I think that's, that question of necessity is something that's so often overlooked, and obviously it's for the DPO to consider that. But say a new DPO comes into an organization and they've got all of these things to deal with in terms of like all of the responsibilities, a tiny piece of information such as an employee start date is going to be overlooked. It's really difficult, and obviously it's so important to get that right in the first instance, but then later down the line it's just a bit of a basket case, really.
Yeah, but even as an incoming DPO, you probably would look at the start date and think, yeah, it's reasonable to have everyone know when you started. More so you can see length of service, but also so you can see people who have only just joined, so you might, want to interact with them in a different way or have a different conversation. How are you getting on type of thing? Well, if you start thinking that's how are you getting on to somebody being in this firm for 25 years, what's going on here then? But, I wouldn't necessarily look at that and think, ooh, that's a problem. I'd probably look at it and think, yeah, that seems all right. That's what I'm saying. Putting ourselves in the position of the data subjects is potentially quite hard.
Yeah. Especially because, you get all levels of, let's say, complaints or opinions on, what organizations are doing with certain people's information. It's trying to balance that across everyone to keep everyone happy isn't an easy task. But I think there's some common issues that most people face with when it comes to data subject rights, such as subject access requests. I think that's a big headache for many. Erased requests depending on the type of organization. But then there's some other personally, I've never seen a data portability request come through the support desk, a query around it and things like that.
No, neither have I. We've got these flow charts we've done for the qualification thing. I don't know if I can show a picture of it. I think we've shared these before with people, but in our SAR training program, we've got, I'll try and share my screen although there's a whole load of rubbish on it. So you have to excuse all the rubbish that's on my screen. for each type of request, let me see if I can make that a little bit bigger so it's less rubbish on my screen. I can't even see, there's a cup in the way. Oh, where's everything's gone? And here it is back again. So I'm technically inept today. So we've got this like flow chart that we've got for erasure requests. Can you hear me or am I?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. We've built these out again to help people in their decision making when they're having a look at, is this a qualified request? Is it valid? So we've got one for every type of request in our training session. And actually that's what's built into our DataWise software. So if you raise a request, it steps you through the process, asks you some questions, and then the system determines whether it's a valid request or not, which leads to, I think, a consistent approach. But some of these questions, that we've got in other rights, I chose your age just for, I don't know why, but is the processing lawful? What's the lawful basis for it? It's a legitimate interest, right? Where's the legitimate interest assessment? Have we adequately considered the rights of the data subject? Even what we're doing on Tuesday, Joe, reeling back this cookie, we're going to get a lot of resistance from the marketing people when we're considering, is it right to use these tracking cookies? Is it an infringement of people's rights? And they'll be saying, no, we need to do it because we need to be assessing this and the next thing. And, evaluating, you know, the effectiveness of our campaigns, etc. Why is it necessary? Is it right? Is it proportionate? Are we the right people to make those judgments?
Us probably not. No, it would be a first party thing, won't it?
It's a difficult thing.
I mean, we can recommend, can't we? But ultimately, it's their decision, isn't it? As long as they can, you know,
It is, and it's our job to challenge it. You know, they've paid us to look at it, pull it all apart, and to challenge the assumptions. You know, the assumptions that the marketing guys have got. You know, using these intrusive technologies. You know, some of which are less obvious than others. You know, like the pixels are probably less obvious than the cookies. You know, should it be done? Shouldn't it be done?
Yeah, we're kind of acting as like the DPO, aren't we, in a way? And I kind of wanted to kind of talk around like the role of a DPO, because I don't know if it's kind of, you know, misinterpreted as to like who a DPO actually works for. And I know that a DPO is, in my opinion anyway, I know a DPO is hired by an organization, but to me, a DPO should probably sit kind of separate from the whole organization. You know, they're not there to lean one way or another in terms of the data subject or the data controller or processor, are they? They're kind of there to down the middle, challenge things and, you know, recommend. And there's only so much you can do as a DPO for that organization. I know they pay you money, but your job is to advise on the law, isn't it? And if you say, you know, you shouldn't really be doing this, and those above you, you know, in the SMT or the directive say, I'm not going to listen to you, then, you know, you've done your duty. That's your responsibility, isn't it, to advise on the law? And I just think I kind of wanted to, you know, knock that around a little bit and kind of just raise it. I think it's kind of overlooked a little bit at times.
Yeah,
it's a tricky one, because at the same time, the purpose of, you know, the GDPR is to allow for the free flow of, you know, data, but also to protect people's rights. So, you know, by that, are you not inclined to think of the data subject, just to play devil's advocate?
I think you need to think of the data subject. The question is, the point is, are you in a position to be able to, can't think of the right word, you know, to be able to look at it objectively is the word I'm looking for.
Can you give an example?
Yeah, exactly. Any example, you know, so, you know, we've got on the one hand a business saying we want to do this, you know, oh, David's got his hand up. On the other hand, we've got, you know, who is representing the data subjects? You know, we are as DPOs, but, you know, do we understand all the different types of data subjects that this might affect, you know, and their circumstances and why they might object to it? Not unless we go and ask for them. I think you're going to go to David and see what he'd like to.
I think you can. You know, you see what comes in, you understand how people are going to challenge. I mean, I must admit, I'm smiling at your start date and why this isn't problematic. And I'm just thinking it's indicative of age, it's indicative of so many protected, essentially potentially protected characteristics. You know, it's those kind of things that I'm really surprised they decided to display it to everyone. I was wondering at the start why somebody would be altering a start date, which is what I thought they were going to object to. But actually, it's display amongst the entire organisation. That doesn't surprise me at all. So, you know, I think, you know, things like legitimate interest arguments, those type of things, we always look at, from our point of view anyway, what do we do if we, because most LI arguments, you can make a good claim for it's in the business interest. The next level, if it's challenged, the overriding interest, we ask ourselves, what would we do, you know, and how would we address this? Because if we've got no way to address it, then we're creating quite a challenge for ourselves if, you know, as this comes up. So we do consider it. Doesn't mean we don't always go ahead and take that risk. You know, I think there is a little bit, you know, I'm quite surprised, although, you know, I don't know the size of the business, and £30,000 doesn't sound much for our business, but I'm sure it's for others, that, you know,
have you got anything to donate?
Cost was considered. Not really. not personally, anyway.
I don't know. Yeah.
But, you know, that. We do look at some of the things, you know, there are decisions that are made due to technical capability, which goes back to the Tom's stuff about what, you know, what's appropriate, what's at the right level and things like that. So I think we also look at technical capability of systems and whether we could or couldn't do things. And that forms part of the argument and how we might respond. But we also do the same for objection and other things. We've mapped out flows on objection, and most of the times it's far more about, you know, objection is until you've responded in most cases. So it's far more about how we can respond quick enough, because we don't believe, you know, we've looked at data flows and gone, you know, we get ridiculous objections to flow, you know, which, like you say, if you take them at face value until you respond, you've got to sort of stop that flow. So what we do is look how can we can respond incredibly quickly so that we don't have to stop that flow. Because, you know, we get people going, I object to my use of my data in this performance process or this disciplinary process or all those kind of things. And, you know, there are different reasons dependent on, you know, as you say, first thing, which lawful interest, therefore, have they used the right objection? Is it objection or is it restriction of processing? All those other good things. But yeah, we look at them. I would suggest we really do consider them and consider the impact if we lose, you know. So we're doing one at the moment where we're looking at automated processing, and I firmly don't believe it's automated processing. However, what we're looking at the same time is, what does it mean to us if somebody came along and said it was automated processing? And also, even going to the point of looking at the case law and going, where people have been found to be, negligence the wrong word, but have been found to be processing and not providing the rights in automated processing, what have the penalties been as well? And in their case, what their case is. And we take the whole piece, weigh it together. And I understand we've got more resources, although you'd be surprised how light we are at times, but more resources than most to address this. But yeah, I would suggest we really do look at some of these things.
I like that example of looking through, you know, your data map and looking at each part of the process and challenging those. I think that's a really really practical advice, to be honest. But I know you'll have definitely piqued Phil's interest when you mentioned flows as well. He loves the flow chart. With that example of the start date, I think what made it more difficult to understand empathize with is the fact that he had displayed it on his LinkedIn anyway. So I think that comes into the emotive side of it. But thank you for your contribution anyway.
Yeah, with that being said though, Jasmine, we both felt it was a bit of an excuse from the organization, didn't we? And the third party that said that, you know, it's going to cost 30,000.
Definitely.
Yeah, because obviously if you have diligent processes in place, if you carry out due diligence on the organization and perhaps a data protection impact assessment, data subject rights should be at the forefront of the things that you're thinking about. And the things that you should think about, okay, maybe we're going to onboard this new system. What happens if somebody objects to something that's on that system, such as the start date? And if they can't do it, then you should probably look at alternative solutions to that problem. So if they put the processes in place as they should have, these things, you know, the problem should never have occurred in the first place if you have diligent processes in place before that.
Yeah, we were butting heads with the third party, in this instance the platform provider, because, you know, when you just feel like you're arguing with yourself or with a brick wall. So they were trying to say that a start date isn't personal data. Oh my gosh, it was painful.
That riled you up a little
heated.
Bit, didn't it?
Got a bit of fire in it, but
but it's that, for me, it's that kind of decision on minimization. You know, each data protection officer might have a slightly different view on whether it's one of that field is one of those that, you know, isn't necessary.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, but I guess it depends on the purpose of why you're using the HR system. Their argument was that, you know, you want to use that. So if you're new to the business and you've seen someone's joined from, you know, say 6-7 years ago, they might be a good person to go through to ask for help. But obviously there's other ways of finding out how long someone's been at the organization as opposed to their start date being on a HR system. You know, you can have these conversations internally, and I could say to, you know, if I was new to join DPP, oh, Jasmine, I've got this issue, who would be the best person to go to? And you might say, oh, Rob's been with us for 4 years, go speak with him, for example. You know, there's other ways around it, isn't there? So yeah, I agree with you, Phil, on that one about it being, you know, absolutely necessary for the purpose of the processing.
Yeah, I mean, I like what Aunt Dale was saying about kind of the question, what do we consider, what if we lose a legitimate interest decision? And I've just brought up the Data Protection Network's legitimate interest handbook with their form on the back, and that, I mean, it's quite a long form, but I can't see any kind of question on that form to say, yeah, all right, fine, well, what if we lose this decision? Again, that should, it's one of those really key things that should be on there. And I like that suggestion of, you know, let's go through the process. And when we get to the end of the process, let's think again at the process. And what if we lose it? Where do we go from here? You know, I think that's a really good suggestion.
Yeah. I think all of this conversation at least clarifies the fact that it's not a simple thing to navigate is rights. I think as an overall perspective, how do you manage rights as an organization? You know, we've got our procedure, which is I think it's well received when we provide it to our customers, to be honest, because it in some ways simplifies the process in terms of having, you know, the initial procedural steps that apply to all rights requests. Yeah. And then the secondary procedural steps, which is more specific, depending on the rights request.
Oh, I'm glad that goes down well. It's good.
Yeah. I think it's the best way to simplify it without, you know, just being bombarded with documents, really.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I was thinking about in terms of rights, you know, we talked about the Data Protection Impact Digital Information Bill a couple of weeks ago, but again, that's going to change things a little bit or a lot. You know, what's your thoughts on the impact of the DPDI bill?
Well, I presume, are you hinting at the addition of, I can't remember what the exemption was, but it's going to be a lot easier, isn't it, for organisations to refuse requests, I believe, isn't it, with the addition of vexatious, and is it excessive, or is that the same thing?
Yeah, it's vexatious or excessive rather than manifestly unfounded.
Yeah.
Or excessive. So manifestly unfounded, the ICO's view is, you know, if there's no foundation, it's unfounded. And if there's manifestly no foundation, it's manifestly unfounded. Vexatious is difficult. I mean, we found in FOIA requests that vexatious is difficult to prove unless somebody is abusive, you know, verbally abusive rather than abusive of process. But maybe abusive process is also one of those things. But there's a fee, isn't there, as well, in the DPDI bill, reintroducing the fees.
Is that at all times, is it, or is that just when it is excessive?
No, you can charge a reasonable fee or refuse to act on a vexatious or excessive request. I mean, similar to what it is now, really.
Sure. Also, I think the narrowing of the definition of personal data could, you know, mean that a lot of things that people might request could fall out of scope of a SAR, because it's, you know, it's not considered personal data. So that could also have an impact. I can't remember exactly narrows it, but yeah, stuff
start
like
date.
That. Yeah. Yeah, I know that would definitely impact. Definitely impact you, couldn't it?
Yeah. I think as well, the fact that there's the talk of getting rid of the DPO and replacing it with a senior responsible individual will have some, it's a bit worrying, really. I don't know, it might affect.
Well, I think that's going to, what David was saying, you know, if you're losing data protection officers and you're moving that responsibility into a senior responsible individual, it's a different role, a different person, different background. You know, presumably you're going to get different results if you start thinking about what's necessary, what's proportional, you know, balancing of rights, you know, depending on who that SRI is. But
could you not say that a senior responsible individual would have a conflict of interest against, you know, because they are, you know, employed by the organization and they're probably not going to feel party to kind of being down the middle, as we mentioned before. So then, you know, they're probably going to act more in interest of the organization rather than like a balance between the two of the data subjects and, you know, what the processing actually is.
Yeah,
potentially.
Yeah. I was thinking the same thing. I've got nothing else to add to that except that concern.
Down to the individual, isn't it, really? Yeah.
But yeah, there's also the changes around the ICO, isn't there? So the right to lodge a complaint with the ICO will be affected, because with complaints that go towards the ICO, there'll be an additional step in which, if the individual and the organisation has not gone down an alternative dispute resolution route, then they might not take the complaint on board at all. I'm not sure if that's you know, qualified or just that, you know, going to happen in every situation, but that'll affect people's right to complain as well. Because the thing is, if you think about, so not everybody's going to directly, you know, come at an organization. Some people might be a little bit more, let's say, introverted maybe, or withdrawn in terms of that, in terms of, you know, arguing with an organization. They might not want to do that. So the ICO is a softer route, let's say, and it's going to take that out or reduce that. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah. I think so. Yeah, I think you're saying that the ICO also represents data subjects. I'm not sure how well they achieve that, but they're a representative for data subjects. I mean, certainly when they get the bit between the teeth on their complaints, you know, for instance, a PECA complaints, then they go for it, don't they? And they're going for it on the cookies. Well, I guess that's PECA at all, isn't it? But
yeah,
you know, where did they go for it to the same extent, you know, in the future on individual complaints? Because their first response in any event is, have you spoken to a data controller about this? That's what they say, isn't it? Go and have a chat with them about it first. So that's always their current, well, in my experience, their first response anyway.
But sometimes data controllers are no help at all. And then at what point do you go then? Do you go back to the ICO and go through this long process of...
That's what you do. I had a complaint about Parking Eye a few years ago, and I wrote to them. They were retaining, they had records of me entering and leaving car parks going back years. I said, you don't need this. Once I've paid my parking fee, you know, and I've exited the car park, you know, there's nothing dodgy going on, then you don't need the data theoretically anymore. So I wrote to the ICO and complained about it because I wasn't getting any joy with Parking Eye. And they wrote to Parking Eye and then wrote back to me and said, no, Parking Eye said they get rid of all this stuff after 30 days. So I sent the file to the ICO and said, well, they don't. It's here. I've done a subject action request. You know, it's go back years. Anyway, they seemingly took some action or said something to Parking Eye, and then they came back to me and said, we've had another word with Parking Eye. But I don't know whether Parking Eye have changed their behaviour or not. Probably not, because they're...
But in another anyway, star. Yes.
Maybe so, yeah. But I go around car parks now. Look at whose car park is. Oh, it's a Parking Eye and I'm not parking it.
Say you have to go through that process of kind of, you know, you're not happy with the response you've got from the data controller, and you go to the ICO and they go tell you to go to the controller and it comes back. But what if this kind of like pressures of around like from a monetary standpoint? So an example, something I kind of wanted to talk about on here is actually our very own Mr. Dacres, Miles, was having a bit of trouble with O2. He came toward at the end of his contract and he wanted to just go on to SIM only to save him some money. And he said, you know, I've got a different provider here and, you know, I'm going to go with them. And someone on the phone said, oh, no, we can match that for you. So Miles was like, OK, great. That's fine. That saves me kind of coming out of my contract. I'll stay with you, you know, on the premise that it's going to match the fee of what, you know, the second provider was going to provide to him. Anyway, off the back of the phone, they kind of hung up and went away. And then Miles ended up getting this bill come through that was just astronomical amount of money. And he thought, you know, hang on here, someone here on the phone calls promised me, you know, that you're going to reduce my bill to £20, for example. You know, why have you sent me this bill? So he put a subject access request in. And I think there was a delay around how long it took to come back. And they asked for his proof of who he was, and they also asked for proof that it was him that actually made the phone call to begin with. Well, how do you prove that? You prove it by putting a subject access request in. So I couldn't really believe, kind of, you know, how O2's stance on this was, you know, for him to prove that it was him on the phone, when the way you do that is by putting a subject access request in. And of course, you know, he could have gone to the ICO and complained, but as you said, the ICO would have said, deal with O2. But what if O2 aren't, you know,
playing ball,
and then, you know, you go through the process of contacting the ICO, which I can't imagine is a quick process, and at the same time every month you're getting set with a bill of, you know, £80, and then he tried to cancel it, and then they said it's going to cost you £500 to cancel it.
Wow.
And then where do you go?
Yeah,
do you know what?
The ICO is not too bad actually, responsiveness wise. It's not like instant, but they're actually not too bad. You'd expect them to be incredibly sluggish, but they're not, in my experience. You know, Rachel's point is, you know, are they, you know, changing the ability to withdraw? We don't know whether you're be able to submit a SAR via the ICO's website in the future or not, but what the ICO seems to be doing is repositioning themselves, or being repositioned as a government department, don't they, under the DPDI bill potentially. which means that potentially lose their impartiality, and you know they might end up taking a on a slightly different role. We don't know, but it's, you know, it's kind of worrying that but John Edwards seems to be behind it, doesn't he? He says, oh yeah, they bring it on, let's change it. Yeah.
I know, it is worrying that. It doesn't really seem to have much backbone, to be honest. Sorry if you're listening. I'm not sure you will be.
That was Jasmine that said that, by the way.
But yeah, I don't know. I mean, we don't even know what's going to happen with the bill in terms of changes. I think I saw, was it the Open Rights Group have brought out some, have written an article displaying many concerns around the bill, especially with the what it might provide government parties in terms of when it comes to elections and so on, by weakening laws.
So some of the motive, we talked about this the other week, didn't we, that some of the motive for the DPR deal might be simply to water down the aspects of the GDPR that apply to political campaigning.
Yeah, make it easier for them to
But the collateral damage, as I would character it, is that everybody else has potentially impacted as well.
We'll change this law to make it easier for us to manipulate people into voting us so that we can pass weaker laws through to benefit us and not the people of the country.
Just back to the O2, where did you get to with that? Because I mean, the other place where it would, you know, Miles would have been able to prove that he had made the call is all calls recorded, probably.
Well,
so, you know, he could have said to them, well, listen back to the call, you know, that you recorded of me, and I'll have jumped through security hoops.
It just
seems a bit excessive, doesn't it?
It does, and I couldn't quite believe that was their stance, that they were asking him to prove that it was him on the phone. And also, kind of, I know that sometimes as a data controller, you are within your right of asking for proof of who someone is, you know, through ID. But I also thought it is where necessary, right? And you'd think that O2 would have his email on file, right? And if you get an email from that person who you have on file asking for his data, surely you'd think, okay, this is clearly the same person that we have on file because it's the emails match up. So are they within their right to ask for the ID?
I think it is quite tricky for businesses like, you know, fast moving consumer goods type businesses where you don't meet your customers. You know, you're selling through a network of retailers or whatever you do, and they're just people on a database. You know, we're fortunate, we know our customers. You know, we talk to them, we meet with them, we know them, you know. But when you're not in a position where you know your customers, then it just makes it a bit harder. And, you know, the obligation really to make sure you don't disclose personal data to the wrong person. And that might mean there's more hoops to jump through for legitimate requests. But I think I'd probably be erring on the side of caution as well, saying, well, you know, we need to be really sure about this. Well, depending on what they want, you know,
I think they just messed up. They knew they'd messed up because calls are recorded, and they probably went back through and thought, oh god, yeah, we actually did say that, and was just trying to make Miles's life difficult, you know, so that he wasn't able to get through to, you know, to say, look, this is the proof that you've messed up. And I think he came to some sort of resolution in the end. I think it was causing him quite a bit of anxiety, you know, quite a heavy bill over his head. He's not what you want, is it? And I think they ended up saying, if you pay 50% of whatever it was yesterday, we'll put you on this new plan. So he did come to a resolution, but I did really feel for him, and it just kind of, I don't know, it annoyed me a little bit, you know, with such a big organization having such kind of poor processes in place. You know, how many other people with O2 are going through, you know, a similar issue? And luckily Miles financially is in, you know, an okay position, but what if someone who's, you know, struggling financially, you know,
well, I had a similar one with
goes
Aon,
through a similar thing.
Eon, the gas electricity company, we got dual fuel through Eon, and way back when, like 2020 or something, the gas meter broke, and we were paying a gas bill of something like £18 a month on standing order, direct debit, whatever, for 3 or 4 years, and they sent people out to read the meter, and they said, oh, the meter's broken. They stuck stickers on the meter and the meter's broken, then put a date on it. So, you know, eventually we said, this can't be right, paying this tiny gas bill. So my wife raised it with Eon, and they came out and said, all right, okay, we'll come out and do a metering. Oh, the meter's broken. Yeah, we've been telling the meter's broken, and your engineers have recorded the meter's broken. You know, why don't you know the meter's broken? So they estimated that we owed them £8,500 in gas.
Wow.
So what? And then, you know, and they were badgering every day, phone calls in, you know, you got to pay this bill, you got to pay this bill. And then somebody on the phone mentioned that there were rules that they can't charge you anything older than a year. So kind of clock to that. But then other people were still saying, no, you got to pay this £8,500. So in the end, we did the subject ask request and got some really kind of flaky information back. Not much at all, hardly worth putting in. I mean, you can't tell me the damn got other information about, you know, about us on file. And eventually, you know, I had to write a very strong letter. And as you say, quote, I'm getting very anxious about this and blah, 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 blah. You know, you need to back off type of thing. And they did, you know, so we settled, you know, a much smaller bill because they're not allowed to bill beyond 2 years back. Beyond 1 year back. But why aren't they getting to that place in the first place? You know, why does it take a lot of aggravation and stuff to before they actually admit that, yeah, the ombudsman's got these rules in place, and yeah, you're quite right, you know, we can't just
probably, you know, because a lot of people
my wife was prepared to pay it at one point. Online banking is not working, I can't pay it. I'm saying don't pay it, you know.
That's exactly what I was going to say. They probably do it on the hope that people, one, don't know that ombudsmen have got things like that in place, and two, they just think, oh my god, it's such a big bill, its interest is going to spike it, you know, monthly, just pay it, get it done, and don't even question it. Where that's probably what they hope for, and probably why they don't have the proper processes in place, because there's probably not that many people that challenge it. And actually, kind of while I've been in data protection and working in it in the last 3 years, I don't think many people in, you know, the outside world, you know, my family, they're not even aware of their rights. In excuse you. but yeah, I imagine that's what it is. I don't think people, you know, in the world, I don't think people are aware of their rights and that they can leverage their rights to find.
Of course they are. They're on the bottom of every privacy notice that everyone reads.
I don't think I'm constantly reminded. I will hold my hand on and say I never read a privacy policy before I joined DPP, and I'm sure there's many people that are out there as well that are the same. Sorry, that really threw me off. That wasn't actually you, was it, Jasmine?
No.
So anyway, right?
It wasn't
so
me.
We are.
Just a
message. So we're. Go on, Jazz.
There was just one other thing that I wanted to talk about today, before we run out of time, if I can compose myself. So someone listening actually might recognise this, because I had a call earlier this week with one of my customers, and they were just, you know, we were just chatting, catching up, and they were, Joe, please, I can't look at you.
I'll turn the camera off.
They were, you know, they were just relaying what they've been on with recently in the data protection world. And they had received so it was a housing association, they received a subject access request from a tenant who had been subject to an assessment by a doctor who was provided by a third party agency, you know, like a health agency or something. And it was to decide whether they needed assisted, you know, like support in
stuff. Yeah,
within the house. And for whatever reason, this individual put a subject access request in, but then aside from that SAR, they asked what the name of the doctor was who made the assessment, because they weren't happy with the findings. So the housing association provided the name because they had it from the assessment, and then they believed that to be a data breach, essentially, like you know, after reviewing it, because the third party health agency, let's call them, weren't happy with the fact that they disclosed the doctor's name.
Yeah, but there's a presumption in the Data Protection Act that is what happens to medical practitioners.
Yeah, so this is what we came to in the end. So spoiler alert.
Oh, sorry,
that was ruined it for everyone.
So basically the breach was handled in and of itself, but this wasn't part of the SAR. And I think it depended on what, you know, was provided within the contract between the housing association and the health organisation as to whether this information should be disclosed, because the housing association shouldn't have had that information anyway. It was by accident that they were provided with that information, which then led to the disclosure. But aside from that, it got me thinking about, you know, exemptions within the Data Protection Act for health health professionals and teachers and so on. And I think it's a part of the data protection law really that's very commonly overlooked. So in Schedule 2, you've got your exemptions for rights, and it can be you know, management forecasting or third party exemption even, whereas this is kind of you know, an exemption to the exemption itself. So within Schedule
1 to me are kind of, I call them enablers, because they're the enablers for processing special category data, and then the Schedule 2 and 3 are the kind of disablers, they're the exemptions.
So you know, you've got your exemptions that, and the third party exemptions, the most commonly known, obviously, but there are some instances in which that doesn't apply, and I just wanted to raise that on here. And that's where, say you've got a health professional, for example, you've got a document with that, with the health professional's name on it, and it relates to some sort of assessment relating to the health of that individual, then that will be disclosable or can be disclosable. I think the same, does the same apply with teachers as well? I know it applies to social care.
Yeah, it's education data, education That's workers, it, yeah. social yeah. workers and health workers.
Yeah, so I just wanted to raise that on here because it's something that I don't think comes up a lot in conversation either.
No, well, you're just throwing that in at the very last minute there. It's big, big discussion topic. Like, just think about that for the next week.
We can always pick it up next week, can't we, on the GDPR radio, unpick it a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, everyone, let us know if you'd like a part two, really. We've spoken about rights a few times, but it is just endless, as you know what there is to unpick. And also, if you've got any questions to come with us, any concepts that you want us to discuss, then let us know. But yeah, without further ado, anyway, we'll call it there. Me and Joe are going to get the drinks ready for Iberica later.
Yeah, we're having a celebration, aren't we? An end of year kind of a do after
we
the
are.
End.
We've got them ready.
And tap has it been nice. Looking forward to it. I'm going to jump in the car in a minute and scoot down to Leeds.
Phil,
are you bringing any of your own brew?
Oh, nothing.
I could bring a keg of it. No, I won't do. I've got.
As long as the company card's on its way, Phil, that's all that matters.
Right. Do you mean you're referring to my comic ability being the company
Absolutely.
Card?
Dave Entry's on his way, isn't he? So I'm sure he'll he owes us a few drinks, doesn't he, really?
He's a card, yeah, definitely.
For whatever reason.
I'm not sure on the reason. I'll have to come up with it by the time I see him.
Yeah.
Anyway.
We'll wrap it up there. We'll be back next week for a GDPR radio session. Thank you everyone for listening as ever. It's really appreciated. And, you know, just joining us in this growing community, really.
Thanks for putting up with us, really.
Yeah. If you've got any feedback, whether it's good or bad, you know, we'll take it. Have a good weekend, everyone.
Yep.
Cheers, guys. See you later.
Bye.